were small and no one knew your name, and you lived in a hollow in the hill. What if no one noticed whether you were here or gone at night as the world grew still? You would be among the lucky ones, pure in how you go. You would know the...
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to Kim Stafford singing a song from his CD, Pilgrim at Home. He's accompanied by Jan DeWeese and Harriet Wingard. This one is called The Lucky Ones. Today, a conversation with writer, author, teacher, singer, and poet Kim Stafford. We'll find out about his new book, 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, How My Brother Disappeared. We're going to hear about his memoir and what it takes to tell family stories and to do personal writing. So stay with us. This is Stage and Studio.
A million stars, and oh, your nights are few. You would be among the lucky ones, pure in how you go. You would know the...
I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Here with me is writer Kim Stafford, who has a lovely singing voice.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Stage and Studio.
Very good to be here.
You know, writing about one's family can be one of the more difficult things to do, but in memoir writing, your family is so important to your own story, so quite often.
Yeah, everybody's story is a family story.
Well, you've written several personal books and poetry. What drives people to tell stories about themselves, but also about their family?
Well, it's the hardest thing to do. So as an artist, you have a tropism toward the difficult, toward the complex. There are many things you could tell. What's the hardest thing you could tell? How could you really serve the human project by diving in and swimming like mad? And a family story is so fraught with danger, but also very deep importance. It calls to me.
I often think that when you're writing, if you're uncomfortable with what you're writing and what you're revealing, that you're probably on the right track? What do you think about that?
I think that's a good sign. Of course, it might be a sign you're on the wrong track, too. So determining, you know, is this taking me to a deeper place? Is this surprising me? Is this the path of no expectation but great resonance? That leads you forward.
Are family stories universal in that way?
I think so. You know, I just got I get comments about this book, 100 Tricks, and I just got one today saying, your recounting is my recounting, though our stories are different.
That's great. You know, one of your early books, I want to talk about 100 Tricks, but one of your early books, Early Morning, Remembering My Father, is about your famous father, who is the poet William Stafford, and you and your family. Did the process of writing that book help you to understand more about your relationship with him?
Well, you know, as I say at the end of this book, we live forward, but we understand backward. And so looking back into the past, it's a mirror that as it gets more distant, it gathers clarity. There's this strange optics in memory. So trying to understand my father after he died, when he sort of has already become a legend, you know, requires digging down. And you know, what are the telling moments? What are the enigmas? What things can't be told but must be told? So that was, in a way, a training for this later book that is more difficult, about my brother's suicide, not about my famous father who prevailed in the world in many ways, but about my dear brother who struggled.
Your father used to tell you and your brother and your siblings to talk recklessly at the dinner table.
That was a great time. He would rub his hands together and say with great relish, let's talk recklessly, you know, which meant all kinds of gossip, but also kind of dangerous inquiry into our own ideas, our own strange sense of humor, and just relish for life.
Have you taken that phrase into your writing philosophy, write recklessly, as far as abandon and joy and danger?
I think the most challenging form of censorship is self-censorship. The most important stories often are the ones we suppress. You know, because I don't have answers to this one, so I better not write about it till I have answers. But the thing is, the only way you're going to have answers is by writing, by writing recklessly and then put it out there, see what you have.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm DMA Roberts. My guest is author Kim Stafford, who has a new book called 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, How My Brother Disappeared. He's got several readings planned for the next few months, and you can see the list on stageandstudio.org, where you can also get a link to Kim Stafford's website and book. Now, we've talked a little about, you and I have talked a little bit about our relationships to our brothers and the theme of taking divergent paths and then having loss when it comes to, especially when it comes to someone you spent your childhood with and you grew up with. Your book, 100 Tricks, is about your relationship to your brother and how he left this world. You mentioned suicide, and that's got to be the most tragic way to leave the world, especially when you're, you know, it's your brother. What made you decide to write this book and to explore that part of your personal history?
24 years of silence. And finally, I just felt I'm carrying these stories. I'm alone with these stories. My sense of my brother's suicide looms too large. I want to bring that into perspective with the richness of his life. And I think to tell the story of his childhood, what a beautiful person he was, imaginative, idealistic, too good for this world in some ways, that story needs to be told to restore my sense not only of his life, but of true value in all our lives.
25 years of silence.
Quarter century.
It was hard to talk about.
It was, and you know how families are. We started with that topic. I asked my sisters for their permission to write this story. It seemed the honorable thing to do. They burst into tears. Mm. They could not say a word. And I felt, this is not getting any easier, but the story's going to slip away. I must tell the story.
I often hear that from people who ask, you know, how do you handle writing about your family and how your family might react to it?
Yeah, it's, to use a military metaphor, it's a minefield. And, when my mom first read the book, she said really a very cool thing, kind of amazing. She said, you know, Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living, but after reading your book, maybe the over-examined life is not worth living either.
There's a fine line, right?
There is a fine line.
Well, you write about your brother's suicide, but a great portion of the book, and it's just so beautiful to read, are memories of childhood, and stories are almost idyllic. You and your brother were great pals. I mean, you explored the world together in many ways, and when you were growing up, but also during the college years. And I like the childhood stories, especially. I mean, what was a typical summer day? Was there a typical summer day? It just felt like you guys were just kind of wandering around a lot, just finding things to do.
Well, you know, every life I think has golden moments. I think Borges said, paradise is real. We experience it at least in moments every day. The sun breaks through. There's a flash of kindness, a smile, a feeling of exhilaration in your heart. And childhood is dense with those. And, it's money in the bank. That laughter you had as a child is gold in the treasury. And I realized that my brother's death, his violent death, was like an iron door slammed shut on all that beauty. And I had to pry open that door and get back to the good time. The way I thought of it, Dime, was it's like reaching back through the difficult end to grasp the beautiful beginning, like pulling a venomous serpent inside out. You know, his death was like a silencer, and I had to get back to the loud music of our childhood.
How did you remember?
Well,
How memory can be murky. And so what did you do to help recall, especially, after so many years?
You know, I say it was 24 years of silence. But actually, as a writing teacher, our basic modus operandi is let's write together in class. And so for years, when I search my memory, moments with my brother have come up. So I've written many, many episodes, some numerous times. And I think that experience, that practice of writing, kept these moments alive in my mind and turned them into little movies in a way.
So when you were going through your memory, you probably had a lot of realizations. I mean, you and your brother both learned so much from your father, William Stafford, but there must have been times it was also difficult to be his son, especially somebody so well known and esteemed. And there's a lot of pressure, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think one of the things I learned in writing this book was how hard our father's fame was on my brother. He was the oldest. He was someone who longed to follow in our father's footsteps, I think, to be a writer, to be a teacher. He tried those things, but they didn't come as easily to him as they did to me. And that was very unfair. That was a kind of betrayal, a helpless betrayal on my part to prevail in things that my brother struggled with. And, you know, if we weren't related, it wouldn't matter. But he's supposed to be the number one son. So that was hard for him.
Well, you're teaching at Lewis and Clark, where your father taught. I mean, what path did your brother Brett take?
He, you know, his path, as I tell in the book, he became a saint very early. When he was 12 or 13, he read Les Miserables, and he announced, "I don't want any presents for Christmas. Send money to the UN." You know, well, that's a kind of crippling altruism, self-denial, very beautiful, but very difficult. And so his path early on was toward kind of punishing himself for being a human being.
What is your title, 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do? What does that refer to?
Well, it's a beautiful story, Dime. When my brother was 10 or 12 years old, he was reading a comic book. We read a lot of classics illustrated, you understand, you know, Macbeth, the Iliad, and so on. And in the back pages was an ad for a book called 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do. You know, for 50 cents, you could get 100 tricks. That's like two tricks for a penny, you know. So he ordered this book. And it was when I thought of that book years later, I thought, that is a beautiful title because I can write 100 little episodes, no one of which needs to tell the whole story. But collectively, they might bring forward my brother's story into a new life.
And it does have meaning for you, too, at the same time.
Oh.
Because it was a magic trick that, I mean all these magic tricks.
Yeah, and you know, what I get to toward the end of the book is the magic reappearance of my brother.
Because he disappeared, and so you're bringing him. I mean, that was the greatest magic trick of all, really.
That's right. Yeah. His, you know, sleight of hand. He went from us. He suddenly was gone. But he refused to stay gone. You know, he early on came to me in dreams. Over time, his figure in the dreams got older, got gray hair, got more kind. He lost the troubled look in his eyes. And in my memories, especially of his early years, our early years together, he became vivid again.
So he reappeared.
He reappeared.
Would you read a section from your book, 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do?
Yeah. This is a passage, Dime, called Path to the Sun, fairly late in the book, that describes the day my brother died. My brother was gone, and I was alone. I was cut off from my own story as I had known it by the bullet that took him. The path that I had seen before me for my life was pulled away. From the last day of his life, I stumbled into the first of mine, the new ragged era with no rules, no assurance. I would have to build this life from scratch. It wasn't a matter of getting over his death. His death was but a single moment for him. But an endless, unforgiving moment for me, for us, for every encounter from then forward with others, and every encounter with myself. I had come to the crevasse and could not cross. I would have to circle back, far back, start a new journey. I would have to explore old terrain in a new light. His suicide was my book of Genesis, and darkness was on the face of the waters, stubborn darkness that no hand could brush aside. The day my brother took his life, as evening came, we were gathered at my sister's house in Portland. My sisters and I decided to sleep on the floor, three in a row. Our brother was gone. How could we deserve a bed, comfort, rest? As I closed my eyes and my mind, I abruptly saw my brother on a path in the mountains. He was beyond me, above me, where the trail led through the trees toward the ridge. His steps slowed and he turned to face me. Without a word, his gaze begged me to call him back. His eyes, hurt and pleading, wanted me to reach with my soul to gather him back to life. But in this trance, with my eyes, I willed him to go on. With one last look over his shoulder, he turned from me and started up the path toward the ridgeline. He reached the summit and disappeared into the rising sun. When I looked down to the path at my feet, it was pulled away like a rope. I was alone in the forest.
You just heard Kim Stafford reading from 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, How My Brother Disappeared. Find out more about it at stageandstudio.org or kim-stafford.com. I can't imagine going through the loss of a sibling, you know, who took his own life the way, you know, the way you had to deal with this and how you wrote about it. I imagine that the book did help you sort through your emotions about this experience, but you write about the week after his death, you had been scheduled to lead a discussion about all people, the poet Sylvia Plath, who took her own life. And that was the first time you talked about your brother's death in public. And,
yeah.
you know, the show had to go on, so you had to do it.
Yeah, I called the organizers and said, you know what, I can't do this. My brother just took his life. I can't hold it together. And, you know, as they said, the classic line, well, no, the show must go on.
Oh,
it's going to happen. And so, you know, this was my first instance, D-May, of being abruptly honest about all things. I mean, there is no...
That was the very first time?
Yeah, that's right.
To be so revealing.
You know, I first thought about it, well, I need to downplay this. I need to kind of act ordinary and so on. I realized, no, that's over. That's done. That's not going to happen anymore. That's not a possibility. And so I remember stepping up to the microphone and just leveling with the audience, saying, you know, Sylvia Plath, you've come to hear about her, but I just need to tell you my brother took his life a week ago. And the thing I was able to say then was that, you know, Sylvia Plath did half a good thing. She told us about the darkness very brilliantly and articulately. But the other half is what we need to do. And that is, despite great coercion and darkness and trouble, we need to go on and we need to help each other go on.
How did people respond?
They were stunned. We were all kind of amazed together that this was not a literary program anymore. This was about survival.
I found that, you know, it was difficult for people. It is difficult for people to respond when you talk openly about death, you know, and you get all these different reactions. Did you experience that? Because it seemed like afterwards you detail in your book that you just started talking to people about it.
That's right. And, you know, some people are not ready and they have my respect.
And yet they want to hear it. I think it's the response that's difficult.
Yeah. People don't know what to say. You know, after my dad died, we got many notes from well-wishers saying variations on the idea, words cannot begin to express and so on. And I thought, that's wrong.
Words
can
try to
begin.
Express.
That's what words are for. That's what being alive is for, to try to get through the tough time together.
You write with compassion and quite a lot about your childhood with your brother and the joy you both experienced, you know, while you were growing up. I mean, you know, many joyful events, you know, in just daily events. But there's a sadness, too, of how your lives grew apart from the closeness that you had. And at one point, you realize that your brother grew up in a household where he wasn't presumed by your father to, and this is your quote, inherit the kingdom. Is there a certain amount of guilt in that?
Tremendous. Yeah. You know, there's a sentence resident in my mind, I killed my brother.
Aww.
You know, that's just there. Now,
wow.
People talk me out of it. I try to talk myself out of it. I know it's not true. And yet...
But you feel that.
But I feel that.
Do you still
by
feel that?
By living, by being Kim, I made life impossible
by
for
being
him.
Successful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that leads me to deeply question what we call success.
Wow.
And one of the beautiful things about my brother, he wrote a dissertation, a master's degree in Canada, University of Victoria, Harmonious Relations. as a social value among the inland plateau Indians. And this whole idea of harmonious relations with the earth, with each other, and with the self has become my quest as a human. And one of my greatest teachers along that road is my brother.
How do you want your brother, Brett Stafford, to be remembered?
Well, you know, as a troubled, beautiful, idealistic person, if you drive along Country Club Road between Lake Oswego and the high school in the spring, you'll see a row of flowering trees. He planted those trees. He left many beautiful things in the world. He fought fires. He worked for world peace. He witnessed. He was a planner. He helped preserve the beauty of Oregon. So there are many memorials to him, and my book is but one.
Well, you were quoted in Jeff Baker's piece in the Oregonian that you're about this incident that he inspired students at Lake Oswego High School to plant these trees, and then your daughter asked you something when you were driving.
We were driving along. She was young, and I was telling her, you know, your Uncle Brett, he arranged to have those trees planted. And she said, did the world thank Uncle Brett for that? And, of course, I started crying and had to pull over. I don't think the world did thank Uncle Brett. And, you know, there are many acts of great generosity that go invisible by. And I hope this book will just help us all notice each other, listen to each other, ask, really, how is it with you?
Well, you don't have to be famous to have made an impact in the world, and I think that's what I'm hearing you say.
That's right. You know, everyone has a gift, and the purpose of education, of parenting, of friendship, is to identify and celebrate that gift. We live in a world where interdependence is our salvation, and so listening and noticing and asking is the human task.
What do you say to writers who want to take on the task of writing about their families?
Here's my manifesto, Dime. You can compose a work of any length or difficulty, given writing solitudes of any brevity, by designing a cell-like structure that empowers you to make steady progress toward a worthy goal. That is, you have a very difficult story to tell. Don't tell it all at once. Name many small parts. Maybe each is a page long. Tell that part and then that part. And, you know, it's the 1,000-mile journey begins with a series of free rides. And no single short writing needs to sum it up or solve the problem. They all together cast a spell out of which understanding may come.
You're so much the consummate teacher, you know. You could look at your book, 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, almost as a guidebook to what you just said. Write little bits of it that will all come together.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine, the writer Teresa Jordan, said, we spend the majority of our energy not saying what we want to say. You know, we're keeping the lid on. And to find a way, I call it the trick of beginning. To begin to write the story with some little, seemingly little piece, and then let that grow. That's the trick for happiness for a writer.
Do you still keep a little notebook in your vest
pocket? Oh, yeah, got it in my pocket.
And after we leave here, you're probably going to write, Dime said
this.
That's
right. No, yeah, okay. I'll get some good lines down.
Well, you can hear Kim Stafford read from his new book, 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, How My Brother Disappeared, at several readings around town. Here a couple to note. November 8th at 7 p.m. at Annie Bloom's bookstore. That's located at 7834 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. And for more info, 503-246-0053 or visit anniebloom.com. November 14th at 7 p.m. at Broadway Books. That's on 1714 Northeast Broadway in Portland. And their number is 503-284-1726 or broadwaybooks.net. And on November 18th at 1 to 4 p.m., there's a book signing at the Audubon Society Wild Arts Festival. It's located at Montgomery Park at 2701 Northwest Vaughan in Portland. And you can find out more at wildartsfestival.org. And Kim Stafford is also reading at Seattle, in Seattle, on December 4th at 7 p.m. at Elliott Bay Bookstore. And for more info, that's 206-624-6600 or visit elliottbaybook.com. And on January 16th, he's coming home to Lewis and Clark College in Portland at 7 to 8 p.m. It's a book launch and reading. For more info, call 503-768-6222. And I've got all of what I just said and a full list of readings for 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do at stageandstudio.org or kim-stafford.com. Kim, do you have a final short reading for us?
I do. Here's a little coda and a consolation, Dimay. When my brother died, way back in 1988, and only yesterday, it seemed his life was gone from me, and his death was a huge thing, the suffocating force. In time, gradually, painfully, but surely, as I have written, that proportion has been reversed. Now, his death is smaller than his life, which keeps growing in my mind and heart. His life is the big thing, his death, the fact that dwindles smaller. My brother begins to blossom inside my body like a flower opening inside a pool. He has gone inside and has become a resident of who I am. I reach out my hand, but can't touch him. He is reaching with me instead towards something else, something that calls my attention now. Since my brother died, in fact, we have never been apart.
That was so moving. Kim Stafford, it's so good to know you and to talk with you.
It's good to know you.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And for writing.
Okay.
And for reading.
Yes.
Yes. Take care. That's it for Stage and Studio. My thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. Before we go today, if you're hankering for some Shakespeare, check out Devin Allen's new production from Our Shoes Are Red, the Performance Lab. She's directing Othello at Portland State University's Lincoln Hall this weekend, November 9th, 10th, and 11th. And for more info, you can call the PSU box office. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on the facebook.com/stage, the letter N, studio. And you can also tweet me at stage, the letter N, studio. We're going to go out with another song from Kim Stafford's CD, Pilgrim at Home. So till next time, I'm Dimay Roberts.
I stopped on a back road at an old country store, left in a trance from the years gone before. At the counter, a woman lost in a dream. I said, how be you? She looked straight through me. It's hard to be alone. You watch how the moon makes a rainbow. You know you can't show another soul. Stars through the rain. Books on the shelf, dusty and torn, filled with wisdom before I was born. How to fix a motor, how to mend a shoe, but not how to be a woman.